and the site's moderators took its most popular sections private, essentially holding Reddit hostage. Days later, Pow resigned. "The trolls are winning," Pow wrote in an op-ed in the Washington Post following her resignation. "The foundations of the internet were laid on free expression, but the founders just did not understand how effective their creation would be for the coordination and amplification of harassing behavior, or that the users who were the biggest bullies would be rewarded with attention for their behavior. No one has figured out the best place to draw the line between bad and ugly, or whether that line can support a viable business model. I'm rooting for the humans over the trolls. I know we can win." Steve Huffman, Reddit's original co-founder, came back as the company's CEO. While Ohanian remained executive chairman, I sat down with both of them in 2016, in the aftermath of Pow's resignation. Did they believe they took online harassment seriously enough in the company's early days? Alexis and I grew up in the generation on the leading edge of the internet as teenagers, as boys going through puberty, Huffman told me. That comes with a certain desensitization. Translation? They simply got too used to it. After seeing what Pow had endured, however, they insisted they were more committed than ever to cleaning up Reddit for good. One of Huffman's first efforts was to continue what Pow had started. He strengthened the company's anti-hate policies and shut down a few more nasty sub-forums, including Coontown, a favorite for racists, and Raping Women, a favorite for, well, aspiring rapists. With each ban, users protested. Some even turned on him. "I've said many times that I thought the way Pow was treated on Reddit was despicable," Huffman says. "The changes we made to the Reddit homepage would have mitigated some of the harassment, and I regret we didn't make those changes years ago." After she left the company, Pow told me, "It's very difficult to change a community once it's gone in a certain direction. What I hope other internet companies realize is when you have problems, they scale with your company, and it becomes very hard to revise the approach you've taken once the genie is out of the bottle." However, there is hope. In a new study, researchers at Georgia Tech found that the changes Pow started on Reddit have made a meaningful difference. After Reddit banned those forums like Fat People Hate and Coontown, more Redditors than expected left the site entirely. Those who stayed were better behaved. Their use of hate speech dropped dramatically by at least 80%. Researchers suggest perhaps existing community norms and moderation policies within these other well-established subreddits prevented the migrating users from repeating the same hateful behavior. Some users undoubtedly flocked to other, more permissive sites. You can now find Fat People Hate and Coontown on a newer Reddit alternative called Vote. But the exercise proved that companies can change if their leaders understand the problem and are willing to make hard choices. But what about free speech? That's a red herring, Pow says. The purpose of free speech is to allow everybody to have a voice, to have these conversations. And if one group is pushing everybody else off, you can have this free speech platform, but there aren't many voices or opinions being represented. Pow strongly believes that if more women, especially women of color, she says they get the worst of the online harassment, had been involved at the creation of networks like Reddit and Twitter and Facebook from the start, the internet would be a very different place. "I think people would have invested more in tools, would have invested more in community management, would have taken down more content faster and banned more people in a more consistent way," Pow says. It's an alternative reality we can only imagine. A company that fought harassment and won. Could the reforms that helped Reddit have an effect even in the troll haven of online gaming? Benchmark-backed Riot Games, maker of one of the most popular multiplayer games in the world, League of Legends, has attempted to curb online harassment without alienating the game's players. In League of Legends, which boasts 100 million active players monthly, teams of gamers battle in an online arena using magical powers. As with many multiplayer online games, vitriolic, abusive, and misogynistic comments slung at other users have been a long-standing problem. In fact, research shows female gamers receive 3 times as many negative comments as male gamers. One player, under her gaming pseudonym, Jenny Hanover, keeps track of such comments on a blog. Entries include, "Shut that fucking bitch up," and "Shut your mouth, girl, before I put my dick in it." Just another day in the life of a female gamer. In 2012, however, the game makers behind League of Legends noticed that a significant number of players were quitting due to these obnoxious comments. In response, Riot Games put together a player behavior team, including experts on psychology and neuroscience, to examine the issue more closely. Reporting on what they found, Wired's Laura Hudson wrote, "If you think most online abuse is hurled by a small group of maladapted trolls, you're wrong." Riot found that persistently negative players were only responsible for roughly 13% of the game's bad behavior. The other 87% was coming from players whose presence, most of the time, seemed to be generally inoffensive or even positive. These gamers were lashing out only occasionally in isolated incidents, but their outbursts often snowballed through the community. Banning the worst trolls wouldn't be enough to clean up League of Legends, Riot's player behavior team realized. Nothing less than community-wide reforms could succeed. Riot experimented with several ways to accomplish this, such as turning off the chat function by default, but allowing players to turn it on when they wanted to. It saw not only a 30% decrease in negative chat, but also a nearly 35% increase in positive chat. By creating hurdles to bad behavior that were minimal but real, it was able to change that behavior dramatically. Riot also decided that when it kicked players off the game for negative remarks, it would give those users more details about exactly why they were being penalized. When those players returned, the company found, their incidence of bad behavior dropped significantly. Riot also instituted a system called the Tribunal that enlisted a jury of players to vote on reports of bad behavior. It turns out the Tribunal gave players a greater sense of responsibility to do their part in creating a more positive environment. Riot Games found that it could decrease negative behavior by enforcing certain consequences, and it could also create more positive norms of behavior. This supports the theory that at least one reason online harassment has proliferated is that there have been no consequences. To put it another way, when you threaten to rape or murder someone in public, you typically experience certain repercussions from the community. At least one League of Legends troll found out that being a model citizen has rewards. A player whose highly negative behavior got him banned from competitive play for an entire year later said, "It took Riot's interjection for me to realize that I could be a positive influence, not just in League, but with everything. I started to enjoy the game more, this time not at anyone's expense." If any of the internet's managers need more convincing, there's this. League of Legends had 67 million active players per month when Riot unveiled its efforts to reshape online behavior. 2 years later, there were 100 million. As Riot waged war on negativity, growth soared. The Riot example reminds us that the past doesn't have to be the prologue. The internet has created unparalleled opportunities for human beings to act out their most aggressive, sexually predatory, and emotionally hurtful impulses. Perhaps none of the founders knew that this would happen, but now they do, and it's worth asking whether they're doing enough to reestablish, encourage, or enforce the codes of behavior that people accept in other environments. They can't control everything. There will always be those who flout social expectations. And we already know that communicating through screens and keyboards creates social distance. However, when these companies fail to do everything they can to create virtual environments that encourage respectful behavior, they should accept at least some responsibility for the impulsive, hostile, and antisocial outcomes. How these companies decide to proceed really matters, because the internet revolution has only just begun. The future is coming. And there is little doubt we'll soon be spending more and more of our lives in sophisticated virtual worlds for both work and play. Those worlds will be dark and disturbing places unless cyberspace is fundamentally reshaped. Safeguarding our virtual future. In 2016, Jordan Bellemeyer, another female gamer who plays under a pseudonym, was visiting her brother-in-law when she decided to try out a new VR game he owned, Quiver, in which players shoot arrows at zombies and demons in a snowy medieval world. Bellemeyer put on the headset and played by herself for a while. But soon after she entered multiplayer mode, another gamer, identified as BigBro442, used his avatar to start groping her avatar's chest. Players could hear each other's voices. That was the only way Big Bro could have known she was a woman, because all the players' avatars were identical, so she said, "Stop." He didn't. She moved away, but when she did, Big Bro 442 started chasing her, then shoved his hand toward her virtual crotch and started rubbing. The virtual groping, Bellemeyer later wrote in a Medium post, felt disturbingly real. You're not physically being touched, but it's still scary as hell. As VR becomes increasingly real, how do we decide what crosses the line from an annoyance to an actual assault? Upon hearing of Bellemeyer's experience, Quiver developers Aaron Stanton and Jonathan Schenker tweaked the game to include a new superpower, one that enables players to surround themselves with a personal bubble that shields them from any kind of virtual assault. But as the industry moves forward, not every developer may act so responsibly. In fact, there's good reason to think that some won't. Engineers are now working to make virtual reality even more real with the help of new technologies such as haptic feedback, which enables players to physically feel it when they're punched or kicked. Augmented reality promises to further integrate our real and online worlds. Increasingly, these are spaces in which we will live, work, and play that will have dramatic physical and psychological effects. The norms of behavior for these new virtual and augmented worlds are being laid down right now. So right now is the time for the makers of VR and AR technology to build respect and safety into their products. Let me be clear. Our shared goal shouldn't be to remove all bad behavior, hateful comments, or potentially disturbing imagery from the internet. That's not only impossible, it's undesirable too, because it involves a slippery slope of deciding whose judgment will determine what's objectionable. A more reasonable goal would be to create an online social landscape that roughly mirrors that of a healthy city. In most cities, you can, if you desire, find a dive bar, a strip club, or a rough neighborhood where rude or obnoxious behavior is allowed or even encouraged. But in most public spaces, the parks, restaurants, museums, and theaters, you should be fairly confident that neither you nor your children will be verbally assaulted or followed around by some creep shouting threats. To make the internet a version of that safe and welcoming city, women should be involved in building the next generation of products from the start. From new social networks to the video games of the VR future. Brianna Wu tells me her heart races when she hears these stories of women being stalked, threatened, and groped in virtual worlds. For her, it feels like deja vu, but on another platform. Running for Congress in Massachusetts in 2018, these are her campaign promises: to help get more women into high-tech fields and to write stronger cybersecurity and anti-harassment laws. Her goal? To make sure that women on the internet of the future don't fall victim to the mistakes of its past. Chapter 9. Silicon Valley's Second Chance. Writing this book has been like going on a trek through a minefield, with fresh minds being laid as I walked. Not a month has gone by without some major revelation about discrimination or harassment in the tech industry exploding in the press, not to mention the deluge of allegations in Hollywood, beginning with Harvey Weinstein, in politics and in the media. Most followed the same pattern: angry accusations followed first by denials and then by public mea culpas. Several powerful men in Silicon Valley, including the once untouchable Uber CEO Travis Kalanick, and the investors Justin Kaldbeck, Dave McClure, Chris Sacca, Steve Jurvetson, and Shervin Pishavar, subsequently resigned, were fired, or were publicly disgraced. There were moments when it seemed we had reached a turning point in how Silicon Valley would treat women, and other moments when it felt that if we had not hit rock bottom, it was only because the bottom was lower than we thought. In response to these scandals, women rose up. At the end of 2017, the Twitter hashtag #MeToo was trending hot, with millions of women sharing their stories of abuse and sexual harassment, both through tweets and on Facebook. That wellspring proved not only the size and scale of the problem, but also that these social media platforms could be used to create solidarity and seek justice. I've never seen anything quite like the environment where now women are much freer to speak up than perhaps they were in my professional career, former eBay and Hewlett-Packard CEO Meg Whitman told me. Every once in a while in history, there's something big that happens that changes the culture, and I'm hopeful that this is it. As we begin 2018, one thing is clear. In tech, people's interest in, anxiety about, and desire for change have become palpable. The exclusion of women didn't have to be the story of how we got here, and it certainly doesn't need to be our future. Let's take advantage of this moment. In previous chapters, I've asked this question. How different might the world be if women had been included in this transformative industry from the start? In this last chapter, I want to ask a similar set of questions that look ahead. What if the tech industry, starting now, grows up and begins to create a truly diverse workforce? How would the industry make that happen? And what would be the advantages to such a fundamental shift? Let's imagine a world where women hold half the jobs in Silicon Valley, where half of entrepreneurs, executives, venture capitalists, board members, and employees, including engineers, are women. We can't know exactly how that world would look, but some are willing to make educated guesses. I think there would be two enormous differences, the longtime tech investor Roger McNamee told me. I think Silicon Valley would be wildly more profitable. I think there would be a significant reduction in the number of absolute failures, and so I think success would go up dramatically. McNamee's scenario isn't wishful thinking. Research shows that companies with more women represented in their leadership ranks make more money, and their employees, both men and women, are more innovative, diligent, and creative. Higher morale and a more successful company mean lower turnover, higher retention, and higher rates of productivity. Another way to look at this is that gender inequality is expensive, in that it leads to more unhappiness, higher turnover, lower productivity, and more money and time spent on hiring and recruiting. What's good for women is good for men, good for companies, good for their customers, good for the products they produce, good for the economy, and good for our future. Europe has already begun to mandate gender parity in businesses and is starting to see the value of it. Countries such as Norway and Germany have instituted quotas to get women on corporate boards, and companies in other European countries are responding to pressure to appoint more female directors, even if they're not required to do so by law. In a wide-ranging study of 2 million public and private companies in Europe, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, found that firms with more women in senior roles realized a significantly higher return on assets. On average, replacing just one man with one woman in management or on the board led to a 3-8% increase in profitability. In the tech sector specifically, the benefit was even greater. Tech companies saw a greater boost, the report suggests, because those companies demand higher creativity and critical thinking that diversity in general may bring. With those results, one might wonder whether firms would do even better with leadership that was all women. The IMF found that when women occupied over 60% of leadership positions, results began to diminish. Having women entirely run our companies wouldn't lead to the best returns, just as having men entirely run them doesn't either. It's the workplaces with balance that appear to have the best results. Silicon Valley 3.0. Silicon Valley has long celebrated failure, encouraging founders to aim big and fail fast, pick themselves up and try again. In that spirit, there's one big failure to add to the list. Silicon Valley has failed women, period, and it's time for the industry to own it. At the current rate, with VCs celebrated for hiring their first female partners, and companies ever so slowly achieving single-digit increases in the number of female engineers and managers, it will take us a generation or more to get to anywhere near 50-50. That's unacceptable. Women not only represent half the population, but drive 70-80% of consumer purchases. If only for the sake of profits, women should not be excluded from the process of imagining and creating new products. There are a few founders who see the opportunity here. Everyone is looking for a competitive advantage, and some tech leaders have realized that there is an abundance of talent and valuable ideas in the populations that, for the last 3 decades, have been largely untapped. Looking at their new women-inclusive businesses and workplace cultures can give us some idea of the potential payoffs. I ran into Dick Costolo in April 2016, 10 months after he'd left Twitter, and he was nearly giddy after having just hired another female engineer at his new personal fitness startup, Chorus, the fourth company he has co-founded in 2 decades. From day one, Costolo focused obsessively on making sure he hired as many women as men, even if it took longer to find them. Once you fall behind, if just 2 out of 20 engineers are women, it's impossible to catch up, Costolo told me. Any one of these companies, the underlying disease is that it's 90% men. Everything, literally everything, is reinforcing the problem. Jack Dorsey, who returned to Twitter as CEO when Costolo left, is also taking an innovative approach to improving the environment for women at his other company, Square. New female engineers joining the company are placed on teams that include other women, rather than alone with a group of men. The hope is to engender camaraderie and networking and mitigate the imposter syndrome that women often experience when they're the only female in a room of male engineers. Still, with a limited number of female engineers, there's a trade-off to this strategy. Some teams will remain all male. It's an experiment, one that Dorsey believes is worth trying. In the meantime, Square has developed a strong bench of female executives. It's not just creating a sense of belonging that's important, Dorsey told me, but also making sure women contribute to decision-making. And then there's the most straightforward strategy, that having women in charge will naturally attract more women. Julia Hartz, co-founder and CEO of Eventbrite, says the company's gender balance is 50-50 and that this has happened organically, perhaps as a result of simply having strong female role models at the top. These founders are attempting to create products that will be used by everyone, no computer expertise required. Hiring only the stereotypical computer nerd that IBM and others were screening for in the late 1960s and early 1970s, those who don't like people and dislike activities involving close personal interaction, would ensure disaster for these sorts of endeavors. Following James Damore's broken logic from his Google memo and hiring mostly men because they supposedly systematize rather than empathize would be equally short-sighted. What these companies need is a tech-savvy workforce with a deep, empathic understanding of people's behaviors, interactions, and preferences. For new technologies like these to reach their potential, they simply must be created by teams with a diverse set of perspectives. Slack, a diversity case history. Stuart Butterfield, another multi-time entrepreneur and founder of Slack, is also proving that building a diverse, family-friendly workforce can be a key to creating a successful startup. Butterfield had his first success when he co-founded the photo-sharing company Flickr with his then-wife, Katarina Fake. Flickr was meant to be simply a side feature for a video game Butterfield was developing, but the game financially flopped just as it became clear that photo sharing was about to become the next big thing. Yahoo swooped in, buying Flickr for north of $20 million in 2005, and Butterfield and Fake became dot-com stars. It wouldn't last. Innovation at Flickr died under the Yahoo umbrella, and Facebook and Instagram ran away with the mobile photo sharing market. Naturally, Butterfield started over. He built another game that failed, then, in 2012, shut the operation down, laying off all but 8 people. But again, a side project of his company's showed great promise. Butterfield's employees had built new software to track projects and communicate with each other internally. That accidental modern take on a chat room, now called Slack, quickly became one of the most highly valued unicorns in Silicon Valley. Like many tech successes, Slack grew quickly. In 4 years, expanding from 20 to over 1,000 employees in 5 countries. But unlike most tech companies, it grew while hiring a lot of women. In 2017, Slack reported that 43.5% of its employees were women, including 48% of managers and almost 30% of technical employees. Far better numbers than almost any tech company in Silicon Valley. Slack said of its diversity efforts in a Medium post, "We're simultaneously proud of what our people have been able to accomplish so far and determined to improve. This is a work in progress." The real question is this: how did they do it? The answer? Butterfield and his team made a critical decision early to make diversity and inclusion an explicit priority. I sat down with Butterfield at Slack's Soma headquarters in December 2016 and asked what he thought it would take to level the Silicon Valley playing field. "It's so funny because I would have had a totally different answer to that on November 7th, he said, referring to the day before Donald Trump was elected president. I just thought the world was getting better, but then it turns out it's not getting better. Butterfield isn't shy about sharing his political views. He's publicly backed Planned Parenthood, protested President Trump's controversial travel ban targeting Muslims, and sent a company-wide memo in 2016 urging his employees to take a pause on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Think about how profoundly shameful it is that there even ever had to be a civil rights movement, Butterfield wrote. 2 years before I sat down with Butterfield, former Google engineer Erica Joy Baker was marching the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, to protest the shooting of a young black man named Michael Brown, when Butterfield tweeted at her, "Be safe." When Baker looked at Butterfield's Twitter page, she realized he cared about diversity almost as much as she did. "He is woke. I want to go work for him," Baker said of her discovery. In 2015, she joined the Slack team as a senior engineer, fully convinced after reading a powerful Medium post by Slack's then-engineering chief of staff, Nolan Caudill, in which he outlined the company's core values. These included diligence, curiosity, and empathy, a stark contrast to Uber's original core tenets, steppin' on toes, always be hustlin', and meritocracy. "Our industry has for decades been directed and built by a mostly homogenous group and has downplayed the accomplishments of others not in this group," Caudill wrote. "We recognized our own shortcomings in this area and thus wanted to be explicit about what Slack stands for and what we're trying to build and who we want here to help us build it. By focusing on how we build Slack first, we can hopefully improve the greater industry in whatever measure." Butterfield is quick to acknowledge that white male privilege helped land him in the CEO suite in the first place. He recalls his old group of buddies from Yahoo who went on to become great successes in tech, including Jeff Weiner, CEO of LinkedIn, and Andrew Bracha, a venture capitalist at Accel who invested in Slack. "All of them are men," Butterfield says. "It's not a conspiracy, but it's also not a coincidence." Butterfield admits that his Rolodex gives him a huge and somewhat unfair advantage. "It would have been the same experience if you worked at eBay in early days, Google, Facebook, or in this generation, Airbnb, Pinterest, Snapchat, Slack," he says. "I have all these amazing contacts that I can call on if I want my company acquired, or I want an investor, or if I want to do a partnership, or I want to hire someone, or whatever. And if you don't have access to that network, it's not impossible to be successful in tech, but it's an order of magnitude more difficult. Not actually insurmountable, but close." There are plenty of women entrepreneurs who deserve funding now, but it's also true that we are in a transition period where men like Butterfield, with influence, connections, and access to money, can help. Women who gain career momentum at Slack will go on to greater things with their own set of vital connections. Butterfield grants that Slack's values may sound like hippy-dippy bullshit. Then, get serious. "We have to make money to be a successful business, but the making of the money doesn't determine whether the whole thing was successful and worthwhile, and whether I feel like my life was well spent. I find it totally plausible that it drives better business outcomes, but I don't think that's the prime reason. The real drivers were, this just seems fairer and better for the world." Butterfield acknowledges that he, personally, is already richer than he ever dreamed of being. Does that make it easier for him to focus on the company's values rather than on its bottom line? To him, they're the same. He says, for the company to make more money is a good thing because it can reinvest in all kinds of stuff, but having some belief in the mission is going to make us so much more effective in the first place. Slack can't change who applied to college 5 years ago, Butterfield points out. So, how can we have an impact? He asks. We can have an impact by making this a good place for people to work. If women are less likely to leave the industry because they worked at Slack, then there will be more people who survived at a higher tenure of experience and therefore a higher role and could go on to be VP of engineering at Slack or some other company in the future. The Slack team is engineering a system that was specifically created to foster teamwork and collaboration. It would simply be bad business not to employ a diverse team that knew something about how people of all types work together to build this product. Though Butterfield knew the kind of team he wanted, he also knew he couldn't make it happen all by himself. "As an already successful white male straight fucking go down the list, I'm not going to have the relevant experience to determine what makes this a good workplace. So some of that is just being open, but really just making it an explicit focus," Butterfield says. The path to creating the workforce and corporate culture he desired wasn't easy. In 2014, when the company was just 50 employees, almost all of them white and male, Butterfield hired the company's first female executive, Anne Toth, who ultimately ran Slack's people operations and recruiting. If there was more than one woman in the bathroom, that was kind of an oh-my-gosh moment, Toth recalls. I knew Stuart wanted Slack to be a different kind of workplace. He used to say, the business fundamentals are solid, but we cannot screw up on the people we bring into the company. We can't screw up on the culture. We don't have the same margins for error that we might on the business front. He was very passionate about who we are. Toth contacted Joelle Emerson, a former lawyer who had started a new business called Paradigm to help tech companies build their diversity and inclusion policies. I first met Emerson in March 2016 at the Airy San Francisco headquarters of Airbnb, another company her team was advising. She speaks incredibly fast and with conviction. Right off the bat, she said, none of these companies are winning and all of them are struggling when it comes to the representation of women. By September 2017, Emerson was mildly more optimistic. We've seen a handful of companies, like Pinterest, Intel, and Airbnb, for example, demonstrate progress in some areas while stalling in others. Sustained progress takes time. That companies shouldn't be congratulating themselves doesn't mean there isn't progress. It means we have a long way to go. One impediment to progress, Emerson says, is that companies have been focused more on raising awareness about unconscious bias rather than educating employees about actions they can take to combat bias. If you focus on trying to raise awareness, you probably won't see a ton of impact. If you train people on actions they can take, that can have an impact, she says. The research shows that the effects of unconscious bias training are mixed. There's evidence that it can wear off quickly and even backfire. Emerson says that's reason not to get rid of the training, but to improve it, in order to help employees to understand why certain changes are being made and empower them to engage with those changes. That's why Emerson is focused on building her learnings about bias into the everyday structure and operations of companies. First and foremost, she says CEOs and VCs need to buy into the idea that diversity is important and hire a head of HR before the company grows beyond 40 to 50 people. With Emerson's guidance and Toth's execution, Slack started by having employees discuss and articulate the company's values, including, most importantly, empathy. And the company started collecting diversity data on its employees. Restructuring the company's interview process was another key component of Emerson's formula. When interviews aren't structured, they tend to be about as predictive as a coin toss, Emerson says. It's only by articulating what you're looking for and assessing for that consistently that we can have any objective evaluation of candidates. The company also ended whiteboard coding interviews. Remember, that's a standard practice at many Silicon Valley companies that involves a candidate writing code on a whiteboard in front of a panel of interviewers. When the candidate is asked to do something they don't normally do and do it in front of someone judging them, it introduces a performance dynamic that can be alienating. Slack's infrastructure engineering head, Julia Grace, wrote in a Medium post. Companies also need to focus on how prospective employees are finding them in the first place. Employee referrals can be one of the most insidious drivers of sameness in company hiring. That is, men are most likely to refer other men. Emerson recommends asking employees explicitly to refer diverse candidates. Just by thinking about it harder and being intentional about it, she says, companies can change surprisingly quickly. Pinterest, another client of Emerson's, has seen significant increases in its percentage of women and minority candidates simply by asking employees directly to refer women and underrepresented minorities. Stuart has said things I've never heard from a CEO, like, can you refer people who look like you to me? I get white guys all the time. You can make a difference. These are things more people need to say, says former director of engineering Leslie Miley, who's African-American. In fact, whenever Butterfield tweeted about hiring diverse candidates, Toth says the company saw ridiculous spikes in inbound interest. Slack also diversified its recruiting team. We have a recruiter who's 60, we have a Latina woman, two African-American women, an African-American man, an Asian man, several Caucasian women, and I can't even count the number of LGBT folks, Toth told me. These recruiters were given explicit instructions to source underrepresented candidates from a broader swath of schools, including often overlooked schools such as historically black colleges and those in the South, for every new role at every level of the organization. We were also looking for candidates who might be older, mid-career, or re-entering the workforce from different geographical areas where typical tech companies weren't looking, Toth said. Recruiting captains were designated for various groups, including women, earth tones, referring to people of color, LGBTQ, and veterans, to promote better understanding and support of those specific candidates. Job postings were reworded. According to Emerson, male bias terms such as rock star and ninja are no-nos, along with words such as brilliant that convey the belief that intelligence, talents, and abilities are innate rather than traits that can be developed. Research shows that job descriptions that contain such language get fewer applications overall and fewer from women. Slack also removed explicit requirements like number of years of experience and specific degrees necessary in the hope that candidates wouldn't opt out prematurely. Today, Slack's job postings clearly articulate the company's focus on diversity, stating, "We believe everyone deserves to work in a welcoming, respectful, and empathetic culture. We live by our values and hire accordingly. Ensuring a diverse and inclusive workplace where we learn from each other is core to Slack's values. We welcome people of different backgrounds, experiences, abilities, and perspectives. We're an equal opportunity employer and a fun place to work. Come do the best work of your life here at Slack." A big bonus of even a little success at diverse hiring is this. Once you get more women and underrepresented minorities in the door, more want to join. The next hire is easier. There's an increasing return dynamic there, Butterfield says. Now that we have this reputation, it feeds on itself. There's an important myth to dispel. Some people think hiring for diversity is illegal. They'd be wrong, says Emerson flatly. Generally, what you can't do is you can't say, here are two equally qualified candidates and I'm going to hire you just because you're a woman. But you can engage in efforts to counterbalance the candidates you're seeing. I would say you have an obligation to do that. Not only is it legal, but you should have to. Which brings me to a point PayPal Mafia member Keith Raboy raised early in this book. He told me that it's important to hire people who agree with your first principles. For example, whether to focus on growth or profitability, and more broadly, the company's mission and how to pursue it. I'd agree. If your mission is to encourage people to share more online, you shouldn't hire someone who believes people don't really want to make their private lives public, or you'll spend a lot of time arguing, time you don't have to waste when you're trying to build a company. But those who believe in your mission and how to execute it aren't limited to people who look and act like you. To combat this tendency, you must first be explicit about what your first principles are. And then, for all of the reasons we discussed, go out of your way to find people who agree with your first principles and who don't look like you. Because if you don't build a diverse team when you start, as you scale, it will be incomparably harder to do so. Retention. Of course, it's about not just hiring women, but making sure they stay. When it comes to retention, Emerson says it's equally important to build standardized review and feedback structures for employees. Slack reviews its promotion data regularly to make sure, as best it can, there are no differences in how men and women are being promoted. The next one is a no-brainer, pay equity. Glassdoor, a company that routinely surveys national and Silicon Valley employment data, found that the overall adjusted pay gap between men and women in the United States is 5.4%, controlling for factors such as age, location, experience, and job title. For computer programming, however, the pay gap is more than five times bigger, at 28.3%. That means women computer programmers make less than 72 cents for every dollar a man makes, compared with 95 cents on the dollar that women make compared with men, nationwide. And remember, tech is an industry that pays in both cash and stock. A tenth of a percentage point in equity can make a multi-million dollar difference if the company has a big exit later. In 2015, Slack performed a comprehensive compensation refresh, and salaries are now routinely monitored by an independent third party. The company is also contributing 1% of its equity to support programs to advance women and underrepresented minorities. But Slack admits it still has a lot of work to do, noting that the representation of women and underrepresented minorities drops at more senior levels. And Butterfield worries that, as Slack gets bigger, it will become even more difficult to maintain current percentages of women and underrepresented minorities, as has happened at Google and other tech companies. And with Microsoft and Facebook encroaching on Slack's territory as they attempt to build their own workplace collaboration tools, another test will be how the company maintains its focus on diversity and core values as it fends off competition. This is why it is critical for Slack to retain the diverse workforce it's already created. When I asked Toth if there were any ping pong tables at Slack, she rolled her eyes. "We have an ethos here. Work hard and go home," she said. That motto is written on posters that can be seen hanging all around the office, which is generally empty by 6:30 p.m. "There's very much a sense here that if you want to play ping pong, you can do that somewhere else," Toth said. The message is that this is a place for grown-ups, and many grown-ups have families. Slack even hosts a daytime Halloween party for the children of employees, with a conference room transformed into a trick-or-treating spot boasting a chocolate fountain. But no tech company is a diversity Eden. By the time I finished writing this book, Toth, Miley, and Baker had all left Slack. Each situation was different, and Slack points out that its turnover is a little less than the average rate for tech companies. But these were marquee hires that boosted the company's reputation as a welcoming place for women and underrepresented minorities. The true measure of Slack's success will be if the company can avoid the fate that befell Google. A few months after leaving Slack, Baker told me the company still struggles with the stereotypes and misogyny that infect every tech workplace. "They definitely have challenges. There's definitely a James Damore at Slack," Baker says, referring to the ex-Google engineer who said there were fewer women than men in tech and leadership due to biological differences. Halfway through 2017, Baker posted an industry-wide diversity and inclusion postmortem on the social code hosting site GitHub, which is popular among developers. In the report, Baker wrote, "We are approaching the 10-year anniversary of the first forays into focus on diversity and inclusion in the tech industry. The industry has spent over $500 million on diversity and inclusion efforts, with little to no improvements to show for it. Diversity numbers remain stagnant. Resolution? This failure is still in progress." Debugging the failure. As I approached completion of this book, I was invited to moderate a town hall discussion on solutions to tech's gender problem at Fortune's 2017 Brainstorm Tech Conference in Aspen. The room was filled with entrepreneurs, investors, and executives looking to network and gain new insights. But as the town hall began, I noticed dozens of men sneaking out of what was sure to be an uncomfortable conversation. The discussion was emotional and electric. In the audience was Ninian Wang, the first woman who went on the record about being sexually harassed by investor Justin Kaldbeck. She took the microphone to propose a third-party organization to oversee the relationship between venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. "Right now," she suggested, "that third party is the media, which means allegations play out in public without careful arbitration." Nicole Farb, the Goldman Sachs banker turned entrepreneur, said she believes Silicon Valley treats women worse than Wall Street does. Her message? VCs, stop asking women entrepreneurs about their kids. When one man in attendance said that some women weren't doing enough to support each other, I spotted OpenTable CEO Krista Quarles getting agitated and mouthing the word bullshit. When I handed her the mic, her voice erupted and her body shook. "In Silicon Valley today, there is a sisterhood of women who are supporting each other, telling each other about board opportunities, giving each other business ideas. There is a sisterhood," Quarles declared. "Talk about sexual harassment. You name it, it has happened to me. And I think that what is happening now is that you're all on notice. This stuff can't happen anymore. It has to stop." Everyone has a role to play. Women, men, investors, founders, executives, board directors, parents, teachers. When I asked the audience who needs to change the most, Adam Miller, CEO of the human resources software company Cornerstone On Demand, who also happens to be white and male, stood up. "Without a doubt, it's the CEOs. We need people that are willing to demand that there's diversity in these organizations, or it's not going to happen," Miller said. "At the end of the day, it has to be a directive from the top." I agree with Miller. Getting to 50-50 is incredibly complex and nuanced, requiring many detailed solutions that will take decades to fully play out. To accelerate the process, change needs to start at the top. Like Stuart Butterfield, CEOs need to make hiring and retaining women an explicit priority. In addition, here is the bare minimum of what we can do at an individual and a systemic level. First of all, people, be nice to each other. Treat one another with respect and dignity, including those of the opposite sex. That should be pretty simple. Don't enable assholes. Stop making excuses for bad behavior or ignoring it. CEOs must embrace and champion the need to reach a fair representation of gender within their companies and develop a comprehensive plan to get there. Be long-term focused, not short-term. It may take 3 weeks to find a white man for the job, but 3 months to find a woman. Those 3 months could save 3 years of playing catch-up in the future. Invest in not just diversity, but inclusion. Even if your company is small, everything counts. And take the time to educate your employees about why this is important. Companies need to appoint more women to their boards, and boards need to hold company leadership to account to get to 50-50 in their employee ranks, starting with company executives. Venture capital firms need to hire more women partners, and limited partners should pressure them to do so, and at the very least ask them what their plans around diversity are. Investors, both men and women, need to start funding more women and diverse teams, period. LPs need to fund more women VCs, who can establish new firms with new cultural norms. Stop funding partnerships that look and act the same. Most important, stop blaming everyone else for the problem or pretending that it's too hard for us to solve. It's time to look in the mirror. This is an industry, after all, that prides itself on disruption and revolutionary new ways of thinking. Let's put that spirit of innovation and embrace of radical change to good use. Seeing a more inclusive workforce in Silicon Valley will encourage more girls and women studying computer science now. People that just merely point to the pipeline issue, they don't get it, Apple CEO Tim Cook told me at a 2017 fundraiser for a girls' high school. The tech companies have a lot to do ourselves. The truth is that in aggregate, we all don't do a good job retaining either. Diversity matters at Apple, Cook said, because without that mixture of input, it would be impossible to create the most desirable products on the planet. To be clear, Apple's diversity numbers, which include its retail store employees, are also average by Silicon Valley standards. With women representing 32% of employees worldwide and 23% of tech roles. But the company has accelerated its hiring of women over the last couple of years. Women accounted for 37% of new hires at Apple in 2016. Our best work comes out of when you have a tremendous level of diversity working on a product. Not only gender, but the artist and the musician working with the engineer, Cook said. When you're like us and you're designing products for the world, don't you want different views? Tech's rising workforce. On a Friday afternoon in the summer of 2017, I sat down with a group of teenage girls at Gott's Roadside Restaurant on the bustling Embarcadero waterfront in San Francisco. They had come into the city from high schools all over the Bay Area, and now, over French fries and chicken tenders, they were talking about their experiences learning how to code. All of them had worked with Girls Who Code, GWC, a nonprofit that offers after-school clubs for middle and high school-age girls and immersive summer programs held at tech company offices. Arita Wong, 16, joined the coding club at San Mateo High School. When I typed something up and it would magically appear on the screen, that realization that you can create something that works right away is amazing, Wong said. Zaina Sheikh, a 19-year-old computer science major who had recently graduated from the GWC program, added, "Seeing the program work, I think it's pretty empowering. With code, you can do so many things." Rhea Thacker, 17, taught herself how to code using Khan Academy online tutorials, then helped start the GWC club at her school. "Learning to code was a really hard process for me, and I thought, how do I make it easier for other girls to do?" Ashley Chu, 15, joined a GWC club during her sophomore year in high school and attended her first hackathon a few months later. "But the thing is, I was on an all-guys team. They had already taken AP Computer Science and were really into coding when I was just new, and I felt like I just didn't belong," Chu said. Still, Chu finished the hackathon. "I was scared, frustrated with my code, and I wanted to quit, but we went through with it," she says. The hackathon hasn't dampened her aspirations. I'm a really big dreamer, and I've always wanted to be an inventor, Chu said. Meet the next-gen potential workforce of tech. Shake wants to combine her programming skills with her love of sports to make a product that will encourage more young girls to try athletics. Thacker is obsessed with airplanes and would like to build an aviation app. Chu is a Disney fanatic who would love to join the company's Imagineering research and development arm. Julie Vu, who says she's given up the idea of coding because of what she's read about sexism at Uber, would like to become a recruiter at a tech company so she can help bring in more women and underrepresented minorities. Or maybe she'll just go into cosmetics. Sanvi Shrisha wants to start her own business and build all the code for it. Nori Klopp-Packel wants to combine her love of spoken language with machine learning. Wang wants to organize hackathons and build education products that bring the opportunity to code to more young girls. The girls sitting with me that day know all too well that women are grossly underrepresented and sometimes even mistreated in Silicon Valley. I'm in some women in tech Facebook groups, Shake said. They talk about being mansplained and all sorts of things. I wish it weren't like this. They all wished for more female role models, like Sheryl Sandberg. Amen to that. But these girls have a very different outlook from women of older generations, and in many respects, they're doing pretty well on their own. One day, while Wang was on her way into a coding club meetup at her local library, a fifth-grade boy asked where she was going. When she replied that she was going to a meeting for girls who code, the boy scoffed, "Why isn't there a guys who code?" Wang exclaimed, "The entire world is guys who code." She is among many young women intent on changing that. She'll be helped by some cultural shifts happening in the world around her. Yes, some girls are still getting the message that they got in the 1970s. Computers are for boys. But at the same time, more schools are teaching computer science than ever before, and more girls are signing up. According to Code.org, in 2017, almost 30,000 girls took the AP Computer Science exam, compared with just over 2,600 in 2007, bringing the percentage of girls taking the test up from 18% to 27%. For 6 years, starting in 2008, the percentage of girls taking the test remained basically flat, but their share has increased every year for the last 4 years. From kindergarten all the way up through 12th grade, interest in computer science has been exploding, Code.org's co-founder Hadi Partovi told me. One possible reason? Rather than focusing on math, computer science courses are focusing increasingly on the opportunity to be creative, which is attracting a more diverse group of students. Even so, girls' peers in computer science classes are still mostly boys, and their teachers are still mostly men. The girls also acknowledge that computer science is becoming more cool, even for girls. In January 2016, 17 Magazine featured a story titled, "We Love Code, Meet the Awesome Girls Who Own It." It was not unlike the Cosmopolitan Computer Girls article in 1967 that touted the role women could play in this then-new profession. But the 1960s also marked the beginning of a crisis in the teaching of computer science, when students flocked to computer science departments that quickly filled to capacity. By the early 1980s, promising students were being turned away based on their GPA or prior experience in the field, which exacerbated tech's gender imbalance. And something similar is happening now. "In my school, there are a lot of kids and not enough teachers," says Wang, who got waitlisted for a computer science course at San Mateo High School. "Everyone's parents want them to try it out, and we're at the height of demand." This foreshadows one of the great fears of the longtime Stanford computer science professor, Eric Roberts, that once again, schools will be unable to meet exploding demand for computer science, and students will be denied the opportunity to participate despite their interest. Roberts reports that the current excitement around computer science mirrors what the industry saw in the early 1980s around the rise of the Macintosh and the PC. Back then, schools couldn't accommodate the surge in interest, so they started instituting GPA requirements for computer science majors, and classes got harder, so that students with prior experience, generally boys who grew up with computers in their bedrooms, might perform better. At about the same time, the number of CS degrees awarded dropped overall, and the percentages of women in the field started to fall. Roberts warns that the young faculty in computer science departments today aren't aware of this historical catastrophe. He writes, our society cannot afford to repeat that mistake. A pattern I've noticed is girls get into the field later in their lives, said Jake. Guys have a much more pre-developed course because they know earlier. There aren't a lot of mentors to look up to, so we don't consider it a career option. I've heard so many times the future is female, but how are we going to do that if we're entering so late as women? In class one day, Sheikh said a male classmate made an offhand remark that he doubted the girls in his class had a genuine interest in computers. I was wearing my Girls Who Code shirt that day, and I was like, bro, that comment is not appreciated here. There are women like me who want to go into this field and not just for the money. I'm here because I want to make a change in the world, Sheikh explained. If we want to see change in this industry, we need to inspire the next generation. It's hard not to be inspired and hopeful listening to these young women's dreams. The girls are already knowledgeable about some of the headwinds that they will face when they open the door to Brotopia. I didn't feel comfortable telling them about the others. They'll find out soon enough. What they made clearer than ever was this. The next generation is coming. They expect to have rewarding careers in tech, and they dream of making a dent in the universe just as the early founders did. When they open the door, let's welcome them and change the valley and the world for them and for all. Acknowledgements. I am so grateful to the hundreds of people who shared their stories with me. There were far too many to fit in this book, but each story helped shape the narrative and the ideas you've heard here. I'm in awe, especially of the many women in technology I spoke with, who've each had careers filled with challenge and triumph. I expect and hope to see them shatter the silicon ceiling together. My deepest thanks go to my writing coach and collaborator-in-chief, Ethan Waters, who truly embraced the importance of this project and cheered me on every step of the way. Ethan spent many months helping me, an anxious first-time author, navigate the thickets of these very thorny issues, gently guiding, debating, and listening. There's nothing more fulfilling than trudging through difficult writing territory and seeing the ideas crystallize on the other side, and Ethan was there for almost every minute. There would be no Brotopia without my perceptive editor at Portfolio, Stephanie Frerick, who believed in this book from the very beginning. Earlier in her career, Stephanie left publishing for 2 years to work at a tech company. She's known someone needed to write a book about the difficult issues facing women in technology ever since. I'm so grateful for the dedication she brought to this process. It would never have happened had my agent Pilar Queen not pitched Stephanie the idea in the first place. Pilar was my rock throughout this long journey, a sure and steady hand who was always there to listen, encourage, and remind me to believe in myself. Of course, I'd like to thank the entire team at Portfolio for giving me this opportunity, including Adrian Zackheim, Will Weezer, Margot Stamas, Tara Gilbride, Linda Cowan, and Olivia Peluso, who deserves all the credit for the meticulous citations. Judith Coyne brilliantly helped me cut down a 500-page manuscript in what seemed like record time. Dana Ledyard brought her unparalleled passion for this topic, as a working mom who also spent 3 years as a managing director at Girls Who Code, to help me hatch the ideas you see brought to life here. Natalie Bonifide, another GWC alum, helped orchestrate the incredible dinner with women engineers at my home in the wake of Susan Fowler's explosive blog post, as well as the meetup with the young female coders, two high points of this entire journey. Hearing these women, young and old, speak of their challenges and their ambitions was motivation to see this through. And special thanks to Natalie Jones, who made sure that, not a fact, hopefully, in this manuscript, was out of place. Brad Stone was my chief confidant, who not only encouraged me to write this book, with fair warning of how much of my soul it would consume, of course, and helped me shape the original proposal, but also fielded many of my most panicked moments. He listened and commiserated whenever I hit roadblocks and inspired me to push forward. Roy Bahat has been a friend, a thoughtful advisor, and one of my biggest, and most brutally honest, advocates along the way. I especially want to thank the many folks at Bloomberg who've helped build our two television shows into what they are today, Bloomberg Technology and Bloomberg Studio 1.0. My longtime producer, Candy Cheng, has always pushed me to be my best and reach for the out of reach. Our managing editor, Daniel Culbertson, was understanding as I juggled the demands of this book with anchoring a daily show. And huge thanks to Kevin Sheekey, Jason Kelly, Laura Batchelor, Brigitte Webb, Emily Haas-Godsell, Aaron Dresch, Jackie Lopez, Corey Johnson, Omar Khosrowi, Aaron Black, Mallory Abelhausen, Jose Valenzuela,